Welcome to the NCO Journal Sergeant's Time Podcast, a new series featuring informal conversations with leaders at all levels, where you'll have the unique chance to learn what makes them tick, what their leadership styles are, and what inspires them. I'm your host, Staff Sergeant Brandon Cox, Senior Editor for the NCO Journal. With us is Chaga Zapata, the Managing Editor, and Sergeant First Class Osvaldo Aquite, NCOIC of the NCO Journal. Today, we welcome 13th Sergeant Major of the Army, Kenneth O. Preston. SMA Preston, a native of Mount Savage, Maryland, joined the Army in 1975 as an armored crewman. Throughout his 36-year career, he served in every enlisted leadership position, from cavalry scout and tank commander to his final position as the 13th Sergeant Major of the Army. It's truly an honor to have you on our show, Sergeant Major. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks very much for you and the team there at the NCO Journal for all you do. And it's an honor for me really to be here and be part of this podcast and to support you and the team.
Thank you, Sergeant Major, and we're very honored to have you today. As like a first question, it's been about 13 years since you retired, Sergeant Major. What are some of the things you've been up to?
13 years goes by very quick, I'll tell you that. You know, it's interesting when I, as I look back over the last 13 years. So when I first retired, I figured that, you know, my job at that point was to, you know, come home, look after, you know, my mom and dad who were getting up there in age and my father-in-law and to get the farm up and running. But there were three volunteer things that I did right after I retired. I received a call from Major General or Lieutenant General, retired Dick Cody, who was the chairman of the board for Homes for Our Troops. And he asked me if I would volunteer to be part of Homes for Our Troops. And I said yes. And then General Dick Myers, who was the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, asked me to be part of the board for the USO. So I said yes. And then Syracuse University was standing up the Institute for Veterans and Military Families. And so I said yes. And I figured, you know, those three boards were very noble endeavors. They were designed really to support soldiers and their families. And I figured a board meeting once a quarter was something that I could handle. And so I did that. And then wasn't long after I retired that we had an emergency board meeting with Homes for Our Troops, and the president and founder of the organization had resigned and stepped down. And at that point, it was a small organization that had just grown very, very quickly, and there wasn't a lot of experience with the organization. So I volunteered to go in as the interim president. And literally, after that board meeting, I packed a couple bags and drove to Massachusetts. And so I ended up spending a year in Massachusetts as the president and CEO for Homes for Our Troops. And for what it does to support our most severely injured veterans and their families is one that's in my mind one of the most important things that we can do as a nation. And then, so after finishing my year up there, I came back to the farm, and literally I was only here for a couple weeks. And General Sullivan, who was the president and CEO for the Association of the United States Army, called me and asked me if I was ready to go back to work. And so he was very insistent on me coming down there to be the director and then the vice president for NCO and soldier programs. And So I did. That's how I ended up at AUSA. And then I spent, I guess, a little over 7 years there. And then as I've stayed on with AUSA as a senior fellow, I'm a member of the board of directors. And I've also served as a military advisor for Veterans United Home Loans and then Veterans United Realty. And Veterans United has been, a great organization. I've watched what they've done to support soldiers and their families. They are the largest VA home loan provider, in the nation. And, they continue to do some, very amazing things on the educational side to really teach service members and veterans and their families about the VA home loan benefit. So it's been an interesting 13 years, but it's been a busy and very rewarding 13 years for me.
I've been wondering, so Major, is it all been work?
Yeah, so I like my little farm up here. It's 17 acres, and it keeps me physically busy every day. You know that I'm up here, and even though I was down in D.C. working, during the week, I'd get back up here, on those weekends that I was free, and it'd be 7 days worth of work in 2 days. But I build cars. I like taking antiques and taking them apart and restoring them and then putting them back together. So I've got a little car collection. I've got some antique tractors that I've built. I've got a couple horses. I've got a 4-stall horse barn out here with about 3 acres of pasture with the horse barn. And so I've got 2 horses out there that I call them pets. They're good for the grandkids, when they come to visit. Doing a lot of things here with the house. It's been an ongoing project since we moved in. The farmhouse, it was in the family for a long time. In fact, we bought the farm while I was in position down in as the SMA, and I knew at some point I'd have to leave the Army, and so we wanted a place to go to when our time was up. And so once we did actually move up here, we realized that the old farmhouse that was built in 1947, was not necessarily the dream house that we wanted to live in. We decided to blow it apart and then rebuild it and put it back together again. So working on the house and rebuilding everything has been also an ongoing project.
Let's go back a little bit further now, and maybe you can talk to us a little bit or paint us a picture of how was living or growing up in Mount Savage back in the 70s.
The town of Mount Savage is probably a population of about 3,000 or 4,000, and then if you get out to the other surrounding communities, it's probably double that population. I was a paper boy when I was in the I guess when I turned 13, I had a paper out here, and this is back when Cumberland is the major city out here in Western Maryland. But the Cumberland Times at that time, had both a morning and an evening newspaper. So, I was a paper boy. I delivered morning newspapers and I delivered evening newspapers. So I was, at 13, I was up every morning at 4:30, 5 o'clock. I was down there when they dropped the papers, and then I had 86 papers that I took and I delivered, and then went to school, and then that evening I had another 86 papers that 86 or 88 papers in the evening that I had to deliver. But the little town of Mount Savage is it sits at the base of Big Savage Mountain, and up here in the mountains, it's it was a great place to grow up as a kid. I spent my summers out, running through the woods and playing. And then, with my newspaper route, in fact, I bought my first motorcycle when I was 14. And so it was a 125 Harley Davidson. It was a street trail bike. And, at that time up here, all the kids had, dirt bikes, and we spent, time up in the mountains. There's, literally thousands and thousands of miles of trails, and there was strippings up there where they did strip mining that you could just ride for days. And it was just a great place to grow up as a kid. So I played sports, played baseball in high school, played soccer, did some track and field. So it was a great place to grow up. And in fact, my wife and I both were seniors in high school together when we started dating, and we've known each other since we were 6. But we got married at the end of our senior year, and it was at that time that there at the end of my senior year that I made the decision that I was going to join the Army.
Can you tell us about that, Sergeant Major? What led you to join the Army? Was it did you have family members, or it was at the tail end of Vietnam? So, tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the Army was transitioning. You know, it just transitioned to the all volunteer force in 1973. In fact, 1 July of this year, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the all volunteer force. But for me, I the realization kind of sets in. I mean, I was academic in school, and most academic students were kind of thought or destined, to kind of go on and go to college. But, I wasn't, I didn't have the grades to get an academic scholarship, and I was a great baseball player, but I knew I wasn't going to get a scholarship to play baseball for a college anywhere. So, for Karen and I, we wanted to get married. We wanted to start a family. We wanted a future together. And so, I started looking into the military, and, I was very fortunate that, both my parents had served. I mean, I didn't grow up around the military or anything, but I knew both of them had served. My father was in the Army. He was, drafted, at the tail end of the Korean War. So he served from, 1955 to 1957. My mom volunteered for the Air Force. I mean, she served in the Air Force from, 1952 to 1955. And, of course, that was a time in the Air Force when, women were not allowed to be married, was not allowed to have kids. And so as she was leaving the Air Force, her and my dad got married. And then they lived together. Dad was stationed in Annapolis, Maryland. He was artillery. He was Nike Hercules missiles, which was part of the coastal defense. And I was born down there in Annapolis, just as Dad was getting ready to leave the military service. And then, of course, both of them were from Western Maryland, and so they moved back here to the farm up in Garrett County. So we moved up there, and I grew up on the Preston homestead, which is where, my dad and his siblings grew up as a kid. But, I made the decision that, I knew that military service for them was good. I mean, they talked positively about it. My father-in-law was also a Army veteran. He was also in the Army Reserve. He was currently serving at that time when Karen and I were dating. So I thought of the Army as a very positive venue, and I still remember sitting down with a young Staff Sergeant Underwood, who was the recruiter, and just talking about all the things that I wanted to do. And of course, my desire was to, go in the Army, do my 4 years, get out, go to college, and become an architect. And I enjoyed architectural drawing and designing. And so he was really working with me very close to get me into, an engineering career field that would kind of tie in with, my desires to become an architect.
And not too long after enlistment, Sergeant Major, and you probably became a very young NCO. What was some of the first leadership challenges that you faced that you remember?
So I did all my initial entry training was at Fort Knox, and back then, the 19 series didn't exist. We were all 11 Echoes, so I was an 11 Echo, and then was assigned to 1st Cav Division at Fort Cavazos. So I got down there to 1st Cav Division. I was assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 8th Cavalry. And 2-8 Cav at that time was a experimental battalion. And it was really testing a lot of the concepts that the Army was looking at for how we needed to be structured for the Cold War fight. And, we did a lot of things. We tested, the three tank platoon concept, which is how the Russian Army was designed, with three tanks to a platoon. We tested motorcycles and dune buggies. So we had, a lot of things going on. In fact, because I rode motorcycles as a kid, I ended up in the scout platoon for a while as an 11 Delta. So I was able to pick up 11 Delta as my secondary MOS. And, of course, the 11 series, the 11 Echo, 11 Delta broke off like in 1979 and became, you know, the 19 series. But at that time, you know, the Army was growing, and of course, you know, the main effort was Europe. So Europe had to be manned at 100+% strength. So a lot of the units back in the States, and especially, you know, there at Fort Cavazos, you know, you had both the 1st Cavalry Division and the 2nd Armored Division. And, you know, those units down there were undermanned. You know, there were times when we were probably, you know, 60% strength. And so for me as a brand new PB2, because I was promoted to PB2 coming out of AIT. And so that's how I showed up there at my unit and ended up in the headquarters tank section. And the headquarters tank section, you know, 2-8 Cav was a tank battalion. It had three line companies. It had a headquarters company, which included the mortars, the scouts, the AVLB section. And then that we had a combat service support company that was separate that included all the S staffs, you know, the S1, the S4. The support platoon, they were all part of the CSS company. But it was interesting kind of growing up in that environment where, you know, we were short people anyway. So you were, as a young soldier, given a lot of responsibility. And, you know, if you did your job every day, did what you're supposed to do, you were a hard worker, showed up on time, you know, you were going to get promoted. So, you know, I was able to get promoted to PFC right away, and then specialist followed right after that, and then I was promoted to sergeant, you know, at 2 years in the Army.
Can you tell us maybe an anecdote or story that you remember from that time about an NCO or a leader that inspired you that you still look up to today?
Yeah, my first squad leader in the Army was he was a sergeant at the time, Dale Stark. So Dale Stark and his wife Crystal, you know, they really wrapped their arms around, you know, Karen and I. You know, so Karen and I were, you know, I was a PB2, and you know, we set off and we drove to the Fort Cavazos. You know, and we found a place off post to rent, and you know, when I first reported in, you know, they were very quick to kind of wrap their arms around us and make sure that you know, we were living in a safe place, and they were doing, you know, kind of family sponsorship at a time when, you know, sponsorship going into a unit, you know, wasn't really a formal program. I mean, they just did that on their own. And, you know, so, you know, they would invite us over for, you know, for coffee or tea and, you know, just to kind of get together periodically. And it was a very positive experience for me. And it's something that, you know, I always remembered throughout my entire career to ensure that, you know, going into a unit that new soldiers were welcomed and they were taken care of, you know, by their immediate first line supervisors.
Okay. But we want to talk a little bit more about what inspires you. And I know that in the beginning you mentioned a lot of these different volunteer and organizations that you work with. But back then, what drove you? You know, you were welcomed into a unit and you were trying to develop, you know, start a family. But what really inspired you then to continue to do the things that you did?
No, that's a great question. And, you know, something that I used to talk about as a Sergeant Major of the Army, I had the opportunity to go out to Leavenworth every month for the pre-command course, you know, to speak to all the new battalion brigade commanders and all the new command sergeants major. But, you know, I talked about the three primary reasons why soldiers reenlist and they stay in the Army. And what I found there, and I always use, you know, my time there at in the 1st Cav Division at Fort Cavazos as my first duty assignment is the reason why I reenlisted that very first time. And, you know, the number one reason is command climate. You know, and even to this day, I can tell you that the division commander for the first CAD division at that time was Major General Julius Becton. And really the command climate starts, with really the two-star command, because they really set the tone for how leaders within that organization are going to command and how they're going to take care and treat soldiers. So, Julius Becton was my division commander. I can tell you that, Lieutenant Colonel Buck and then Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton were my two battalion commanders. Captain Ivanko, First Sergeant Thee, was the company commander and first sergeant while I was there. Of course, Dale Stark, Charlie Long was my squad leader, platoon sergeant, after Dale Stark had left. So it was just one of those environments where you looked forward to going to work every day. It was one of those kind of environments where you knew you were part of a team and you knew that you were a valued part of that organization. So command climate was the first thing. And then the second thing was job satisfaction. So for me, I love tanks. I love being on tanks. I love working on them. I love training, the maneuver, the gunnery phases. We went through, we spent a lot of time in the field. We had, we were selected to do the BART test, which was the Basic Armor Reliability Test, which was a test designed to determine if it was better to put money and resources into the older tank systems or go on and develop the Abrams tank. And, so we tested, each of the three line companies had five tanks each. One company had five M48 A5 tanks. One company had five M60s, and the other one had five M60 A1 rise passes. And literally, it took everybody within that company to man those five tanks, not only to man them, but then also to provide the data collectors, for being able to go out, spend a month doing force-on-force maneuvers, and then transition straight into a gunnery density, and then to come back, have a two-week reset, and then they would rotate the tanks from one company to another, and then we'd go through that same training schedule again, back out into the field for another month of maneuver and force-on-force, another gunnery density, and so on. So, for me, being in the headquarters company, we were the op four for those units out there while they were training. So I spent a lot of time on tanks. I was a scout in the scout platoon, and the Army was paying me to ride dirt bikes. So so job satisfaction was very positive. And then the third thing was quality of life, and it's quality of life. Not only for you as an individual, to have the time to do, the things that you want to do in your own personal life, but it's also, a quality life for the family. And for my family, I knew that the quality of life that we had was as good or better than what I could have provided going back to the farm, living in a mobile home or something at the farm, working the farm part-time while trying to go to school. So for me, it was, one of those decisions that, when Karen and I sat down and we talked about it, we were enjoying our Army life. And, I had the opportunity to, continue and further my education on my own time. And at the same time, we always wanted to travel and see the world. So, and then that would follow, when we left there and went on to Germany for our second assignment. But those three things, I've always talked to the pre-command course, because the command climate within any organization is really all about the leadership, and it's all about how you take care of your people and how you keep them informed.
So, Major, I want to throw you a curveball here. Okay, that'll kind of change it up again a little bit. Could you tell us maybe about a significant either character testing or character shaping moment in your life or during your career in the Army?
Yep. Sure. Okay. I'll give you this since we're talking about Fort Hood and, you know, early days of my career. So I was I got promoted very quickly to sergeant, and you know, even as a specialist, I was the gunner on the battalion commander's tank, and of course, you know, the battalion commander, really the only time he ever got on the tank was during gunnery. You know, he really spent most of his time, you know, commanding the battalion, you know, from, you know, the battalion talk. But except for Colonel Hamilton, I mean, Colonel Hamilton did spend, you know, more time, but you know, Colonel Hamilton rode in the loader's hatch. I mean, because that's where he felt comfortable, commanded the tank, you know, he had plenty of room. And I, you know, got him from where we needed to go. I mean, I was a tank commander of that tank. It belonged to me along with the crew. And, but one of the things I remember, I was out there and we were cross attached to Alpha Company, and I got a call on the radio. Came into the Alpha Company talk, and I still remember Sergeant First Class Tart was the platoon sergeant that we were working with. But he came over and he says, hey, Sergeant Preston, and he handed me a little slip of paper. He says, hey, you got to be at this grid coordinates tomorrow morning at, you know, 0600 for a promotion board. You know, of course, I was just a young specialist at the time. And so I said, Roger that. And you know, I kind of, you know, did some prep. And, you know, the following morning, you know, I, you know, dug my last, you know, we'd been in the field at that point for almost a month. And you know, I dug my last, you know, clean set of fatigues out of my duffel bag, and you know, me and it's just me and the driver. You know, we only had a two-man crew, but you know, PV2 Benny Hare was my driver. So off we went, and it was probably about 10-12 kilometers away, and it was out close to a place called Antelope Mound, and you know, I saw the GP small tent up on the hill, and so I kind of put the tank into, you know, a position down there at the bottom, and you know, put Private Hare up in the TC's hatch to monitor the radio, and you know, I get out, put on my gear, and made sure my helmet was straight and chin strap was tight, and then off I went up the hill, and you know, went into the battalion command sergeant major's tent, and there was, you know, my first sergeant, there was another first sergeant in there, and you know, I reported to the president of the board. And, you know, the battalion sergeant major asked me about, you know, the position I picked for my tank. You know, why did I pick that particular position? And I said, well, that's, you know, that's the direction of the enemy. And, you know, I've got the tank in a, you know, a turret down position, you know, doing overwatch and security. And, you know, I had, you know, my gunner was on the radio watch. And so he asked me a few other questions about, you know, what I did. And, and then he said, well, you're doing a great job. He said, get back to the fight. And that was my promotion board.
Oh,
and
surprise.
So, I mean, it was no grilling, no questions. And so that was one of those defining moments for me that helped me shape, particularly as a battalion and a brigade sergeant major. It kind of helped me mentor my first sergeants about, you know, who they were selecting for promotion and why. And, you know, it's up to us as the senior non-commissioned officers to make sure that, you know, those young soldiers that are stepping up to become non-commissioned officers are ready and prepared for the job. But at the same time, it's also, you know, designed to recognize the fact that, you know, those out there that are doing a great job, you know, to reward them in some way. And that was, I think, their way to, you know, reward me and tell me that, you know, I was doing a great job. And, you know, so my promotion board was all of about 5 minutes, I just went back to the tank, got back on the tank, and went back to the fight.
Is that, Sergeant Major, is that one memory that kind of stands out, kind of above all others, like that holds a special place in your heart of your time in the Army, or is there something else, like another, like a memory that really, you know, has a special spot.
No, that was a very special spot. I mean, another one too. I mean, I left, so it wasn't long after that. I mean, I got promoted to sergeant in July of 77. And so it was February of 78, I left Fort Cavazos going to Germany. And I was assigned to the 1st Battalion, 33rd Armor in a place called Gelnhausen, Germany. And it was part of the 3rd Armored Division. And so 2nd Brigade, 3rd Armored Division was a heavy infantry brigade. And 133 Armor was that lone armor battalion in a heavy infantry brigade. And it was also, it became a very special place. It was, when I first got there, though, it was, I was beginning to think that maybe I made a mistake reenlisting, you know, because I had to reenlist because I was at almost 3 years in the Army at that point, you know, a little over 2.5. And then, you know, with initial entry training. So I was just shy of 3 years on my 4-year enlistment. So, you know, I had a choice. I could have went to Germany and finished out my last 14 months and then, you know, sent Karen. Of course, our daughter was born at that point, and, you know, sent her and our daughter back to back home to live with the parents, or, you know, I could reenlist and take the family. And so we wanted to travel and see the world, so we did that. You know, I reenlisted, and you know, we went as a family to Germany. And of course, at that time, you know, when you get there, you had to go unaccompanied, and I lived in the barracks for about a month. And you have to find a place. You know, either have to have government quarters or you have to have a place off base before, you know, they would release the passport for the family to travel. So during that first month living in the barracks, I was really disappointed. Just that, you know, the morale, the esprit de corps was really very low. You know, the barracks was dirty. It was nasty. And there were some thoughts in there that maybe I made a mistake, you know, reenlisted, that, you know, this unit that I was in at Fort Cavazos was a model unit. And now I'm in this unit that's, you know, totally just at the opposite end of the spectrum. And, but, you know, I said, nope, I'm here. We're going to make the best of it. And, you know, I found a place off post. And it was also during that time that, you know, we had a brand new, you know, company commander, brand new first sergeant come in and take over. And this was another defining moment for me. And my career was, you know, James E. Bessler as a company commander and, Gary P. Pastine as a first sergeant, I watched them as a command team, you know, completely change the dynamics of that company. And I watched that company over the next 2 years go from being very low on the totem pole to being one of the best companies in all of USSR. And at that time, you know, with 220,000 soldiers assigned to Europe, you know, to be at the top or be one of the best companies in all of Europe, I mean, that's a significant achievement. And but it was an amazing opportunity to be part of that unit, just to watch how they, you know, progressively and methodically change the dynamics of that organization. And it became a great place. It became a great place to serve. And, you know, for the soldiers that were there, it was one of those assignments that, you know, you remember for your entire life.
So training, experimenting with unit formations, you talked about some of your leadership experiences, some of those things that help you develop you as a leader. And let's fast forward now to 2004. The Army's, the Army's at war. And all of this experience that you've had, and here you are, you're now the Sergeant Major of the Army. What were some of those challenges that you faced, as the Army is shifting to combat operations from this old type of, like Cold War era type of formations? Because you had to do that all, right? You had to transition the Army into this new form. So maybe talk a little bit about your challenges.
So, you know, 2004, in fact, I was a senior Sergeant Major. I was 5th Corps and then the combined Joint Task Force 7th Sergeant Major in Iraq, all the way up till the 21st of December of 2003, and then, you know, I'd already been selected to be the SMA. So Joe Schoomaker let me stay there in Iraq up until the end. We were transitioning with 3 Corps, you know, out of Fort Cavazos, and of course 5th Corps at that time, it was based out of Germany. So I stayed there until the 21st, and as we were doing this transition, and then I left there because I had to get back to Germany to out-process. And, you know, Karen was back there, and she had already, you know, had all the household goods shipped. You know, vehicles were shipped. She was in the guest house. And so I out-processed on the 22nd and 23rd. I flew on the 23rd, got back there. Had 4 days for Christmas, and then reported into the Pentagon on the 28th. And so going into January, one of the first things that SMA Tilley gave me the opportunity to do was to, you know, go down to Fort Bliss and, you know, where the, you know, he was sponsoring the nominative Sergeant's Major conference. And there were, you know, 300 senior command star majors and star majors there. And, you know, and he really literally handed it over to me and gave me an opportunity to understand a lot of their challenges. And, you know, for me, just coming out of theater and then, you know, really kind of sitting there and understanding their concerns, because, you know, here in the audience, you had both active Army National Guard and Army Reserve. So you had all the senior SAR majors from all three components. And so going in as the SAR major of the Army, what I found was, you know, the first thing that we had to do from an Army leadership perspective was restructure the Army from the Cold War structure that we had to a modular brigade combat team centric force. And, you know, there were a lot of enablers out there. You know, as we took, for example, you know, the 3rd Infantry Division was the very first division that we put through transformation. And as we got them back from Iraq towards the end of 2003, the first thing we did was we took the division apart. We added some additional infantry. We had added some additional reconnaissance. We took the division enablers and moved them down and embedded them within the brigade combat team. And, of course, through this transformation, we stood up the 4th Brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division. So not only was it a restructuring of the force to put all the enablers within the brigade combat team, because that's how we were covering down on battle space. You know, you put a brigade combat team in and, you know, you want it to be modular in design so that you can take one brigade combat team and replace it with another brigade combat team, irregardless of what division they were in. So it was important that we had a modular force, and it was important that they had all the enablers that they needed. And it was important also that we grow, because at the time, you know, we had 150,000 soldiers in Iraq, and there were about 30,000 soldiers in Afghanistan. So when you think about those numbers, you have to think about that, you know, there's, you know, 150,000 soldiers that are just come back from Iraq, and there's 150,000 soldiers on the ground, and there's 150,000 that are getting ready to go. So you got to think about each of those theaters as far as, you know, getting ready to go, those that are deployed, and those that have just come back and are resetting. So the Army campaign plan that was going on at that time was very dynamic. The vice chief really is the one that, you know, kind of runs the staff within the Pentagon. And, you know, to be part of all those meetings and to be part of the decision-making process that they had gone through to equip each of those units before they deployed, to make sure that, you know, they had all the right personnel and end strength and the right grade levels, and then to make sure that, you know, it was all done so that, you know, they had all the new equipment that they needed for training prior to deployment, and then at the same time when they come back to make sure that, you know, one, the unit was able to reset themselves, but also to be cautious about the PCS moves, because, you know, you've got, you know, those service members that were, you know, stationed overseas, whether it was in Europe or it was in Korea. And if they came back from a unit that had just deployed, they could potentially be assigned to a unit that's going out the door on another deployment. So it was a very dynamic time with all the different transformation efforts that were going on, the fielding of all the new equipment. You know, I remember Secretary Rumsfeld, you know, he asked a young National Guard soldier there in Kuwait. He came over for a visit, and, you know, the young soldier asked him about, you know, why they didn't have up-armored Humvees. And, you know, and the secretary replied, well, you know, you go to Army with the Army that you have. And, you know, of course, that was, you know, hit all the papers. But, you know, what the secretary said was true. I mean, you go to war with the Army that you have. And what a lot of people didn't realize is, you know, you take up-armored Humvees as an example. You know, we had 500 of those in the Army inventory. And, you know, the only reason we had up-armored Humvees was for the military police. And, you know, the military police during combat operations in a defensive role, particularly as you look at Europe, you know, they were the ones that were, you know, up there near the front lines. They were the ones that were within artillery range for a potential, you know, Russian invasion back into Western Europe. So, you know, it was a requirement for them to have up-armored Humvees because they were the ones that, you know, did the traffic management to allow units to be able to move very quickly across the East-West German Czechoslovakian border at that time to make sure that, you know, we had the right units where they needed to be if the Soviet Union, you know, decided to, you know, invade Western Europe. So it was. I mean, we were really structured for the Cold War. And, you know, just fielding all the new equipment, whether it was up-armored Humvees, it was body armor was another one. You know, it was, you know, I used to get asked questions all the time about, you know, why do we not have, you know, the outer tactical vest and sappy plates for every soldier? I mean, you know, we were wearing, you know, Vietnam-era flak vests. And of course, if you had the, you know, the desert uniforms, and, you know, you had this smock that went over top of the, it was the old BDU woodland camouflage pattern. So you had a smock that you wore over top of it to make it desert tan. But it was just interesting, you know, that, you know, the equipment that we had at that time was really structured for the Cold War. And literally, you know, people talk about building, you know, the airplane while in flight. You know, the Army did that. And it was just a miraculous achievement for what the Army did. And of course, you know, we had a lot of support from Congress to ensure that, you know, we had the resources to, you know, be able to man, equip, and train, you know, the forces that we needed to going into combat.
It's funny, Sergeant Major, you're mentioning these, because that was one of the things we were talking about, myself and Sergeant Akite, because we were deployed, and I was deployed in 2003. I was in the Marine Corps from in 03, and then again in 04 through 05. So we were talking about that, because you were the SMA in 04 when we were facing some serious challenges when it came to dealing with the insurgency and you know, not having up armored Humvees. And when you're talking about the sappy plates too, I remember having to, you know, having my Marines go somewhere and I wanted them to be protected, and I gave up my sappy plate, and then I went and begged, borrowed, and stole whatever I could find from my other guys. And it was a serious challenge, and we were curious about, you know, what you did to face those challenges from your perspective, from your position as the SMA. Because I can only imagine just the kind of things that you're being pulled in so many different directions, I imagine.
Yeah. So, you know, just as a point, I mean, for me as the SMA, I did a lot of travel, and, what a lot of folks don't realize is that, you know, the Pentagon and the Pentagon staff is just, it's a great, great organization. And there's a lot of, you know, very smart, very talented leaders that are back there, all wanting to do the right thing. So for me as a Sergeant Major of the Army, I was really the eyes and ears for the Pentagon staff. You know, and you know, if you look at the duty description, you know, yeah, I'm the senior enlisted advisor for the Chief of Staff of the Army, but I'm really also the senior enlisted advisor for the Vice Chief, the Director of the Army Staff, the Secretary of the Army, but also the Army, you know, the Army staff in general, you know, the G3 and the G1, the 2, the 4. So I spent my time traveling, and it was really, you know, the opportunity for me, particularly coming out of Iraq after having been there for the whole first year, and then, you know, really getting out and taking a look at those units out there that were getting ready to deploy. And I could take, you know, the decisions that were made in the Pentagon and go out and see how those decisions were being implemented on the ground. I had a great relationship with the commanders out there, so they could be very honest and forward with me on, you know, their challenges and, you know, what challenges they had executing the missions that, you know, my boss had given them. And so it was an opportunity really to kind of come back from that and share those observations, you know, in detail so that, you know, the folks there in the building could really understand the impact of the decisions that they were making, you know, on the force.
Yeah, this is so I'm sure you saw it. You know, you saw a bunch of units out there. You know, we were an infantry company, airborne infantry company. We had just come back from Afghanistan. We got refitted and we went to Iraq. But we, you know, we only had one Humvee in the entire company. To now we're needing to have every platoon have a Humvee. It was difficult. It was difficult to get used to that equipment. To, like you said, Sergeant Major, we had green Humvees, and we had to get make mud out of the sand with the little water that we had, and we tried to plaster it so it can look like they were up armor Humvees. We put, yeah, you know, plywood on the sides, trying to make them, you know, any little thing that we could do to kind of provide some kind of protection, because things were limited. But I'm sure it was difficult for you to make some of those decisions, and it, not only in the equipment part of the decision making, but also in keeping units longer than they expected to be there. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
You know, for our time that was there, and you know, of course, the Iraqi army, you know, when we went into Iraq, I mean, they were, you know, supposed to capitulate and, you know, go back to their home bases and stand by, but, you know, but really what happened was they took their uniforms off and they disappeared into the local populace. So, you know, as the insurgency continued to fuel itself and get worse, you know, the decision, you know, in April of 07 was to put a 5-brigade combat team surge into Iraq. And while we were, you know, going through a transformation at that time, we were growing the army. You know, I mentioned, you know, the 3rd Infantry Division, you know, we took them apart, dissected them, you know, added some additional infantry, reconnaissance, intelligence, and then put them back together. And with that stood up a 4th Brigade. And we did that not only with 3ID, but we did it with, you know, the 101st. We did it 10th Mountain. We stood up 2 brigades because they only had 2 brigades. So as each division, you know, was deploying, I mean, we were restructuring them. So by April of 07, you know, we had grown the army by a few brigades, but to put an additional 5 brigade combat team force into Iraq over a 6-month period, no other organization, no other army in the world could have done that in the short amount of time that we did, to man, equip, train, and send 5 additional well-trained brigade combat teams into combat was a magnificent accomplishment. And, you know, so we went from having was 11 brigades, and then, you know, with the additional 5, we ended up with more than, you know, 50% of the force deployed, which is what forced us to go to, you know, 15-month deployments. We had, 15 months boots on the ground with 12 months of dwell time. And, you know, of course, you know, General Casey came in as the chief of staff in April of 07. And, you know, we talked about that, you know, we did not want no units to go back for a second 15-month deployment. So it was a tough time for the Army to, you know, one, do the surge, but the surge worked. And, you know, and the insurgency began to you know, go back down again. You know, security became better across the country. And we was able to kind of, you know, move forward more with, you know, moving the country forward and getting the leadership in place. But, you know, those 15-month deployments, you know, put a huge stress on the force. I mean, we had to pull, you know, 2nd Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division, which was based in Korea. You know, 2nd Brigade deployed from Korea to Iraq. And then because of, you know, no one had made a decision, you know, where was 2nd Brigade going to go when they came back? And it wasn't until just before they redeployed that the decision was made that they were going to go to Fort Carson. And so there was a lot of those dynamics that was going on. And of course, there was some challenges in there with the families. We had the brigade out of Alaska in April of 07 that had already started redeploying back to Alaska. And we had to, you know, turn them around. In fact, they were supposed to come back in August. They'd already started redeploying in August of 07. And we had to, those that came back, we had to send them back to Iraq for an additional 3 months. So that created, you know, huge challenges up there for them. And, you know, we had to send a Tiger team from the Pentagon up there to help those families. You know, many of them had already shipped household goods and, you know, they'd already sent all their winter clothes and everything because they thought they were leaving in August and September. But, you know, since they were going to stay there until December, you know, we had to, you know, help them get themselves set back up again and take care of the families. So it was just a real tough time during that period, 2007, 2008. And then, of course, as the surge came out of Iraq, then we had the surge going into Afghanistan. So, you know, as I think about the numbers, you know, and I'll just talk brigade combat teams for a minute. You know, if you, you know, when I went in and to the Pentagon in 2004, you know, we had 33 brigade combat teams in the regular Army. And you figure, you know, we had 13 of those was in Iraq, two of them was in Afghanistan. So that's 15 brigade combat teams deployed. And then, so if you're doing 12 months in, 12 months out, that's 30 brigade combat teams there. And then you also have to take in consideration that, you know, we had two brigade combat teams that was in Korea that were not part of the rotational force. So really we had 31 brigade combat teams that was supporting, you know, a 15 brigade combat team mission. So that was 12 in and 12 out. So when we did the surge in 07 and we added the additional 5 brigade combat teams, you know, at that point we'd already grown the Army to about 38 brigades. So with 18 brigades deployed between Iraq and Afghanistan, and you know, we still had 1st Brigade of 2nd Infantry Division in Korea, you know, we were supporting, you know, a 20 brigade combat team fight, you know, with, you know, like 38 brigades. So it was more than 50% that was deployed at that time. And that's what forced the Army to go to 15-month deployments.
You know, Sergeant Major, I know we could probably go on and on talking about Iraq and Afghanistan. And rather than digging deeper into that, I think I'd like to ask you one thing that kind of came to the forefront when the opportunity to chat with you came up. And that was, you know, your seven-year time as Sergeant Major of the Army. Longer than any other Sergeant Major of the Army. And I'm just curious, you know, as to why you were – how is it that it came about that you were Sergeant Major of the Army for so long and so much longer than everybody else?
When General Casey came in as the Chief of Staff of the Army, you know, he had just spent 32 months in Iraq as the MNFI commander, so multinational forces Iraq. And of course, he came back, and you know, General Schoomaker, you know, retired, and so General Casey came in, and he told me, he says, "Look, I'm not ready to pick a sergeant major of the Army right now with everything that's going on." And you know, of course, 07 was the surge and everything, and so he asked me, he says, "You know, I'd like for you to stay with me for, give me a year." And I said, "Yes, sir." So I said, "Yes." And, you know, so I was 6 months into it. You know, you got to make the announcement to replace an SMA about 6 months out. Okay, that's really about the minimum. And so I had everything laid out, everything ready to make the announcement. I took it into the boss, and then he said, you know, he says, it's just a real bad time right now with the surge and everything that's going on. And he said, if you would stay with me one more year, probably about the 2 year mark would be a better transition, you know, between the chief and the SMA. So of course I said yes. And so I said I'd stay for another year. And so again, you know, we go through and, you know, we get close to that, and now it's, you know, it's 2008. And again, you know, the Army's, it's a tough time because, you know, we just switched out secretaries of the Army, the vice had switched out. So we had a new vice, and so General Casey at that point said, you know, he said, I'd be perfectly happy if you just stay with me. And so I wasn't going to, you know, bail out on the boss. He said, you know, he needed me, and, you know, with the surge then going into Afghanistan, I said yes. So that's how I ended up staying as long as I did.
Is there anything specific that jumps out at you as far as your proudest accomplishment while you were in the Army?
I was asked that question when I interviewed to be the division sergeant major for the 1st Armored Division. And the thing I guess I would say always that I'm most proud of is my family. You know, to one, to have a family, raise a family, and, you know, for them to grow up in the Army. You know, I'm really very proud of my children, and of course now all the grandchildren. So it's you know, they're all doing very well, and you know, it's something that you know, for me it was just a very positive, you know, military career. I mean, we never lived anywhere for more than you know, 2 or 3 years, except for the Pentagon. But you know, but really every assignment was always, you know, 2 or 3 years, and then we were packing up and we were moving. But yeah, I'm really most proud of is the family, because that's the thing, that's the legacy that for all of us, you know, when we're all long and gone, it's the legacy that will continue. And I want to believe that, you know, my family are big supporters of the military. They all serve in different ways. My youngest son is, in fact, he's just retired from the Army as a Army Reserve military policeman. So it's, you know, really proud of all they've done and what they're doing right now in their life with their children.
Okay, here's our final question, Sergeant Major. What advice would present day you have for newly promoted Sergeant Preston back in the day, back in the 1977? When you got promoted?
Yep,
back when dinosaurs walked the earth, Sergeant Major?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We were all 10 feet tall, and dinosaurs walked the earth. You know, I would say, you know, don't be afraid to make mistakes. You know, just, you know, learn from your mistakes every day. Take, you know, the accomplishments that you have they're not solely yours. You know, there was a sign that was posted at the north end of Schedule Hall there at Fort Knox when I got there as a young staff sergeant gunnery instructor. And that sign said, you know, take, you know, all that you gain here in this school is not solely yours to keep, but yours to take and impart unto others in your units and your organization. So for me, I would tell myself to, you know, one, you know, everything that you do is not solely yours. It's the team, it's the squad, it's your unit, it's your organization. And to be a good teacher, you know, it's, it's important out there for non-commissioned officers to be the subject matter expert, you know, to take the expertise that they've learned from hands-on experience and use that to grow future sergeants. And, you know, as I look back over my career, it's, you know, it's been those things that have brought me great success, but it's more importantly, it's brought my units and the people that have worked with me, you know, great success. It's about teaching them what right looks like. It's about teaching them, you know, how to be the best that they can be.
It was truly an honor to have you on the show today, Sergeant Major.
No, thanks. It was a great honor to be here. And I just, again, want to tell you guys, I'm very proud of what you're doing out there. And I'm glad to see the NCO Journal continuing to contribute and make a difference in our Army for our leadership, our soldiers, and our non-commissioned officers.
Stay tuned for more interesting guests and inspiring conversations right here at the NCO Journal. Submit your articles, get published. Don't forget to visit our webpage and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time on the Sergeant's Time Podcast.